Do you think the Earth is hollow? In a moment, we're going to get an update from Brooks Agnew on the possibilities of a hollow Earth. And then we're going to spend the rest of the program talking about the arc of millions of years being 2012, the Mayan calendar end date. What does it all mean? We'll be back with Brooks Agnew in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Brooks Agnew spent most of his youth hanging around Caltech and the folks who co-opted Jet Propulsion Labs. He entered the Air Force in 1973, where he became an electronics engineer, worked his way up through the college ranks. He was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HARP, Holes in Earth. Dr. Agnew has recently co-authored a landmark publication on the creation of the Earth, The Arc of Millions of Years. Here he is. Welcome back, Brooks. How are you?
Thank you, George. It's great to be here.
Oh, my pleasure. Let's get you an update for the next 15 minutes or so, if you would, about the hollow Earth and the quest. What's the latest there?
Well, of course, there's been a lot of evidence come in the last 6 or 7 months, seismic information, defining the core of the Earth much better. 4 days ago, we had two aurora borealises, one over the North Pole, one over the South Pole. It happened to coincide with a time when the solar wind was very low, less than 350 kilometers per second. The proton density was really light. Bottom line is, it really adds credence to the idea that there is a thinning of the crust at the poles, and we have a strong ion stream coming out of the Earth into our own atmosphere, creating the aurora borealis from the ground up. As you know, a year ago in February, NASA launched the Themis probes, which is a set of five satellites that went up to try to understand better why the aurora borealis behaves the way that it does. We don't really have a lot of data from those satellites yet. And I think the reason is the data that's coming in conflicts with the normal, or shall I say, mainstream geological viewpoint of how the Earth is constructed. We're trying to get access to that data now.
Okay, the trip that you were planning, of course, is on hold for now, but you still would like to go, right?
Well, it's scheduled for August of 2009. We were going to go in 2008, but in... as luck would have it, in 2007, we did a 13-city tour promoting the expedition. Well, it created such popularity that people went and booked the Yamal, which is the nuclear-powered icebreaker, 4 months ahead of schedule. So when it came around time for us to make a move in December or January of 2008 for August of 2008, it was already booked. So we had to postpone until 2009, and it's a good thing we did. We picked up a great producer in Hollywood, and we also picked up a sponsor, which is helping us contact corporate sponsors, which will help us retain some of the film rights when we get done with this.
Absolutely, because this could be huge if you do find what you're looking for.
Well, you know, there are several aspects to this. One is, of course, the global warming aspect, being that the ice caps have really melted back. But it's still a long way to where we want to go. It's not exactly the North Pole. It's way high in the Arctic Circle. And there's really only one ship that can make the journey, and that's this nuclear-powered icebreaker. We've looked at diesel-powered icebreakers, but they just don't have the fuel to get there, spend 7 or 8 days taking measurements, and then get back. And the last thing we want to do is get locked in ice for a year up there, not being able to get back.
If you find that Admiral Byrd was correct, if you find that there's a hole up there in the middle of the planet, how do you think this trip will take place? Explain the parameters for me, Brooks, assuming you find what you're looking for.
Well, if our calculations are correct and our measurement teams lead us to the right spot and we find at the very least an opening in the crust deep beneath the ocean where perhaps two oceans are blending and sea life is passing back and forth, and that's the reason we're seeing these million-year-old life forms show up in fishermen's nets all over the planet, that's going to change everything. It's probably going to earn the team that finds that the Nobel Prize in geology or oceanography. But at the very most, if we do find a curvature of the crust and we find something like Edgar Rice Burroughs' hole beneath the fog in the north region, then everything changes. And we will be broadcasting film, or digital anyway, live during the entire 15-day voyage. So what we see, you will see.
Now, the curvature would be ever so slight that you really wouldn't notice it as you move along. Would there be then ocean water right into the curve? I mean, it would just keep flowing in, right?
Yes, there would. And you're right. The curvature would be so slight because the Earth is the diameter that it is. We only have about 8 or 9 miles of perspective. So if we are looking at a curvature with a radius, you know, anything greater than that, you're really not going to notice it. It's all going to be sea level to you. That's why we have to have a precision gyroscope on the ship so that we can track the curvature of the Earth by watching this stable gyroscope. Once it begins to over-rotate, we know we've sailed into what's often called the oceanic depression.
If you bolt yourself into this thing, how do you get out of it?
Well, the idea is not to sail this 23,000-ton, 75,000-horsepower ship into the Hollow Earth. I don't think the Murmansk Shipping Company would enjoy that. but we could circumnavigate it, and there is a smaller boat on the ship, and there's also a helicopter on the ship. So we do plan on making daily excursions by air from the ship out ahead and off to the sides so that we can cover a lot more territory in a very short amount of time.
So you could fly into it?
We could.
Would you see anything, do you think, except for water?
Well, other witnesses, not the least of which is Admiral Byrd, say that there is a place where the warm wind blows. It is a place where there's liquid water and tropical plants and birds and bees and flowers, and that's not the kind of thing we should find up there. But if we do, we're going to get it on film.
Well, and he also witnessed extra beings that live down there.
Well, if you go by a lot of the writings that are circulating, one is actually called the Admiral Byrd Diary.
And not be his diary, right?
Yeah, and I've spoken to a couple of people who actually held it in their hands, and they're getting on up in years themselves and can't remember all the details to it. We have to be skeptical because we're scientists. We're not going up there on channeled information. We're going up there once we leave the dock in Murmansk, Russia. There's no turning back. There are no supply ships. There's no rescue ship. We have to take everything with us that we're going to need, and it's not going to be easy. We're talking high seas, high winds, cold temperatures, icebergs. There'll be seasickness, possible injuries. It's not going to be easy.
Beyond your own curiosity, Brooks, do you think the opening is there?
I have to believe that there's something to the evidence. As we approach it, as we refine our hypothesis, as we build better experiments based on the data that's coming in from remote viewing, from satellite data, from earthquake data, we're getting better and better at refining our measurement systems. It looks promising that there is a gap between the crust and the core. It may be as little as 200 miles. It may be as much as 1,100 miles. But I can tell you, if there is a void there, there will be life there. Now, it might be microbial, and it might be highly complex.
Do you believe that modern scientists, through governments, know that this opening is there?
Wow, I have my doubts. You know, of course, I trust my government implicitly. I know they tell me everything they know.
Yeah.
So let me get my tongue out of my cheek here.
Yeah.
I think that based on the data and based on the lack of data from very good instrumentation that's been recently launched, I think they're holding back something. And lots of people have written me letters and phone called me and said, you know, they're not going to let you go, and the government is going to prevent you from going. And I just don't believe that at all. I'm not much of a conspiracy theorist, and we have no fear. We're going forward.
Yeah, I was just with Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell a few months ago in Washington, D.C., whom I trust explicitly. And he tells me that he believes we're being visited by extraterrestrials, always happen to have occurred and is happening now. So one question I've never asked him, Brooks, whether he believes in a hollow earth theory. He might have seen it.
It's interesting. We look at satellite data as much as we can get our hands on, and the poles, for some reason, are covered with a very thick cloud cover most of the time.
Most of the time, that's true.
Even the 1968 photos, which had to be pieced together like a pie when they were stitched together, and mind you, this is film, not digital. And then, of course, there's a large void in the middle where the core of these pictures are put together. There's cloud cover going as far back as 1968. The only way to see it by air is to fly under 4,000 feet, which Admiral Byrd did. Hence, he's an aviation hero instead of a statistic. But we can't get a pilot today to fly a jet under 4,000 feet. They won't do it. So the only way there is by sea. And this is the first expedition of its kind.
If the hole is there, how far down do you think it goes? Does it go all the way through? I've seen drawings that this planet looks almost like there are two pieces to it, and it's not totally connected.
Well, that's because you're looking at it on a flat piece of paper.
Okay.
What you need to look at it is like an orange that has a small hole in the top and a small hole in the bottom. And then there's a void between the skin and the core of the orange. So it's difficult to draw on paper. So what you're seeing is a cutaway of the hollow Earth. If the continents, and this is another really excellent piece of data, the continents of Earth fit together exactly like a key and a lock all the way around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And not the shoreline that you see, but the continental shelves that are beyond the shoreline.
Like a puzzle.
Yes. And when you fit them together, the Earth is one-third its present size. So if you triple the diameter of the planet, then there's got to be a void between the core and the crust. And I'm looking at some data from the University of Illinois that was recently published, and we've got it posted on our website at phoenixsciencefoundation.org. Incredibly, they have measured using really excellent seismology a solid core of iron crystal, which is much, much more dense than regular iron, which makes a lot of sense since even if we take the density of our current crust, which we've only bored into at about 3 or 4 miles. In fact, the deepest hole in the world is being bored in Russia right now, and it's going to go to 40,000 feet. We just shipped 15 shipping containers of lubricant up there, so I know how deep that hole is. That's a barely scratching the surface of our planet, George. We're talking a crust 800 miles thick.
Can you imagine if you find this, what it would do to science?
Well, hopefully it would do the same thing that the discovery the Earth was round did.
Yeah, probably even more so, because it opens up the question of what else is there.
Sure. I mean, if you think that the Earth is being visited by ETs and has been visited for a long, long time, what is it, 60-something percent of the country has actually seen a UFO, where do they park? Where do they stay when they're here? They don't go back out into space and then come in for a brief visit and then leave again. They've got a home here somewhere.
And it could be right there in the hollow Earth.
Very well could be. Lots of legends say it is.
Brooks, we're going to spend the rest of the program talking with you about your latest work, The Ark of Millions of Years. Before we get to the commercial break here, give us an overview of this.
Well, this is the third book and final book in the trilogy. When we originally wrote The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 1, it was just under 1,000 pages. Our publisher said, no, cut it in half. So we did, and we released that book, and it jumped up to number 48 on Amazon. It was amazing. Then the second book came out 13 months later. This book ties the three books together. So you've got the complete end times analysis from a religious standpoint, from a historical standpoint, and also from a scientific standpoint, all in three books. Now, the last part of the book, it's a part two, actually, is called Unlocking the Secret. Because when we got finished with the End Times books, there was so much doom and gloom in it. We just had to have a message of hope at the end of
it.
So there was a recent publication called The Secret. It came out. It enjoyed magnificent marketing. And lots of people took advantage of it. But it was missing the tools. The math and everything was missing from it. So I decided to take a look at it mathematically and from a physics point of view. And we actually discovered the physics of the soul in this, and we put it in the book. The last 125 pages are a stunning a paternal way to look at the law of attraction. And it has nothing to do with metaphysics. It's all science. It's all mathematics. And we've proven it over and over again that it works.
How do you tie it into 2012?
Well, the Mayans originally had a mathematic calendar. And it was built, we believe, using the Sol King wheels. The Sol King wheels were, it is believed, fashioned either by Abraham or were given to Abraham and were used to very accurately tell time in multiple dimensions. So accurate was this calendar that even Moctezuma knew when Cortez was going to arrive, what he was going to be sailing, and why he would arrive.
Well, this date now, December 21st, 2012, where so many people have come up with so many different kinds of theories, as you look at it, we're going to get into it tonight. You have made an incredible glance at global warming, regardless of its causes, and you somehow tie it into the Mayan end time.
Yes. What happens is, as the solar system in our part of the galaxy goes through the zodiac, the axis that goes through the center of the Earth actually draws a circle in the zodiac. We're coming to the end of the age of Pisces, and we're getting ready to start the age of Aquarius. Mm-hmm. This is the, shall we say, 11 o'clock position of the Mayan calendar. That is to say, it's the end of the age that was originally quoted by Christ, by Muhammad, by several other prophets. This is the end of the age. And what it means is that this solar system is arriving at a place in our galaxy where it lines up with the rift in the galaxy, which it's believed is a corridor that leads directly to the black hole, a supermassive revolving black hole at the center of our galaxy. That alignment is going to energize a lot of things in our planet, and it's going to cause the two phases of matter that make up the Earth, and we discussed that from the first volume, to separate. And it's also going to cause all the planets in our solar system to warm, and they are all doing it.
And it's starting. It is starting. So to me, the 2012 date may not be the beginning, may not be the end, but we're in that time period right now.
Yes, and it's not like December 21st, the lights turn on.
Right.
It's a gradual warming. In the last 19 years, we've had a satellite called Cassini going around Saturn. Mm-hmm. We've been monitoring its things like atmospheric pressure and spectrum. In the last 18 years, the atmospheric pressure of Saturn has gone up a staggering 30%. If that happened on Earth, there would be no life left on this planet. Fortunately, we don't react like that. But on our planet, the rearrangement of temperature spectrums across our planet is melting the North Pole, freezing the South Pole, moving the Gulf Stream around, changing weather patterns. And it's really going to, in the next 5 years, take some radical right-hand turns. And we are going to have to adapt as a species.
More to come in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. I'm going to talk a lot with Brooks Agnew about Earth changes, the Mayan calendar end time, his work, the arc of millions of years. Matter of fact, you might want to get up to his website and take a look at some of the work. And Edgar Cayce once said that North America would have drastic changes. We'll also get Brooks' take on that when we come back. Brooks, how do you think the Mayans knew this? They knew of the changes to occur.
Wow, that's really a great question. There is a lot of evidence in their artwork, not just the Mayan calendar, that indicates they were visited by, the, in our records, at least in what we were able to find, they were called the Shining Ones. These were highly advanced beings that visited them, gave them a complex language ready to go, taught them how to plant, taught them husbandry, taught them architecture, taught them about the stars and cosmology, and also taught them about dating and how the solar system moves through the universe. For instance, in L. Tai-jin's version of the Axis Mundi, which is a very popular tourist attraction as far as people going down there and looking at what's carved, but it depicts a wormhole. And if you look at how it is dated and how it opens, in 2012 it opens again. So it looks like they knew ahead of time, even in the 5th century, that this solar system was going to work its way back around to where it would line up with a gravitational tube or a portal or what we call in science fiction a wormhole. Of course, our physics community, even in theory, we don't believe that a wormhole would be stable. And the reason we commonly say that is when we work out the math of it, we realize that it has to be built with what's called exotic matter. We would say that would be neutron star matter, because right. We just don't have anything dense enough on this planet to even think about it. But it's commonly constructed from the inside out, and what it does, it opens up vacuum fluctuations between one part of the universe and this part of the universe, and it's kind of like sticking the microphone up against the speaker of your stereo and turning the volume up full blast, only the amplifier doesn't clip. It destroys both sides of the wormhole. And the interesting thing is, because you're linking vast distances across space, it appears to collapse before it ever forms.
Isn't it amazing that they were able to do this with help, let's say. Let's say this visitation indeed occurred. And here we are getting close to these dates, and things are beginning to happen. And I'll tell you the other thing that I find fascinating. The collider, the particle collider in CERN in Switzerland, that is coming online this year. And, you know, they're heating it up as we speak and cooling it down, but it's going to go online. This could cause a hole, they say. Could cause many black holes. Isn't it bizarre that it's only several years away to 2012 as well?
Well, it's even more bizarre that the coming of the super collider, the actual formation of these mini black holes, was predicted by ancient civilizations. They actually talk about these instruments being toyed with by modern society, and they tried to leave us a warning not to do it. A lot of people don't know how a super collider works. We've built several small ones. We take gold ions and we accelerate them with electromagnetic accelerators at each other, like two fire hoses aimed at one another. And occasionally, the two ions hit head-on. Usually, they glance off one side or the other. But when they hit head-on, they annihilate each other. And in that annihilation, they blast subatomic particles up against the detectors. And even if they only exist for a billionth of a second, we get to see what the subatomic particles, the protons and neutrons, are made of. Well, we've done it, but not really done it well, because we haven't had enough power. But this CERN supercollider is powerful enough to make it happen. This Hadron collider will actually form miniature black holes. Now, they'll be the size of a proton, but gee, if I remember my descriptions of the Big Bang, wasn't the whole universe in a spot called a singularity about the size of a proton?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, now, what are the other factors, though, that could contribute to what's going on now?
Well, of course, we have dark matter and dark energy, which makes up 94, some people say 94, some people say 96% of the universe. And we don't really know the nature of dark matter and dark energy, but we can see its effects on the matter that we can see. Some people claim that it's energy that is in the process of collapsing from wave function to particle function. Some people say it's just beyond the spectrum of anything that we can see or detect. But we do know that the universe is packed with it, both dark matter and dark energy. And we know that it's not uniform throughout the universe. It's moving much quicker at the outer parts of the universe than it is in the inner parts of the universe. And that's a good question by itself. Which part is the inner part and which part is the outer part? As it turns out, in our perspective out here at the edge of the Milky Way galaxy, we don't really have a good ruler to measure it, because the furthest extent that we've sent the satellite out, and it's not even equipped to measure those kinds of things, is about the edge of our solar system. So we just don't have great perspective. But we really honestly believe that the Mayans and, you know, possibly the Atlanteans and the Lemurians, that they understood these greater forces in the galaxy and the universe because they came from those places to here, and they brought that knowledge with them. And if that's not the case, then they were taught by others who did come from those areas. There's just no way to measure those things from Earth. But in answer to your question, we are now nearing a place in the galaxy where new responses are happening in this ecosystem we call Earth.
Which we can't even figure out yet.
Well, a lot of people can figure it out, but it's slow moving in science. Even though we have the internet, even though we have a lot of very bright people that are getting access to data like never before, in science we have kind of a, well, we have a religious community of peer review, and it's slow to get new data to come forth, and it's very difficult to get your hands on funding to launch another NASA program. We now have 67 active NASA programs in space, and the funding is spread thin over all of them. So you basically have grad students, which are one notch above slave labor, working on them until they can get their PhD, their postdocs done, and then get out and get a real job and start supporting a family, because you're not going to do it working for NASA. We just don't get the best data quickly enough to respond. And we're 5 years away, at best, from this this 2012 date, this crescendo. And if we're going to respond to it as a human race, we need to react now. We need to get new science, new energy, new places of refuge now.
You know, we could have a total polar shift, yet science doesn't even talk to us about this. And it's a very real possibility.
Of course it is. We have taken geological samples up near the Arctic Circle that show a very broad range of alignments of the poles of the Earth. Now, these alignments occur when lava comes up through the crust and then it freezes. It assumes the magnetic alignment of the Earth at that time. Well, when we go up near the Arctic Circle, we see these tectonic spectrums of north and south pole alignments in mountains and in rock that hasn't moved for hundreds of thousands of years. And guess what? Sometimes it shows the north as south and the south as north. And this is, you know, according to the Coriolis effect, something that could occur rather quickly, like in a matter of days, the north and south poles could switch. And we could talk a little bit about what the effects would be on the surface of the planet.
Oh, sure.
Could happen.
Yeah, I'd love to know, because some people, I've asked this question, Brooks, many times. Some people believe that we could go instantly. Other people think it's gradually. And some people think nothing will happen at all, which I don't believe. I think it'll be pretty drastic.
There's too much evidence that the poles do shift, north and south poles do shift. And if the core is detached from the crust, as we believe, and the core is thus counter-rotating against the crust, creating our powerful magnetic field, which we call a magnetosphere, if all those things are true and line up, then we are setting ourselves up, or the planet is set up, to do a Coriolis flip, that the North and South Poles could flip. And I mean in somewhere between 72 hours and 5 days, this flip could be complete. Now, it doesn't take an atmospheric physicist to understand what's going to happen, but I'll explain it briefly. The North Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere have different weather patterns. For instance, if you drain water down the tub in Australia, it goes clockwise
right.
instead of counterclockwise
exactly.
and opposite up here. Well, the jet stream does exactly the same thing. Clouds move counterclockwise and clockwise in different areas, and so do the oceanic currents. If all of those things move and move suddenly, you're going to have conditions set up for what's called a global superstorm. Now, these are snowstorms, but they're not ordinary snowstorms. They are super cold, and they cover large geographic areas.
And in terms of the intensity, how intense is it?
Well, according to what we've uncovered in the book, and this goes back 26,000 years as far as we can gather data, we could be facing winds of 300 miles an hour, and those winds could last for a month or more.
That would knock down practically everything.
Once you got sand and glass and rocks moving at that speed, it would literally sandblast areas
everything.
Of the planet.
And we are talking planetary-wide, right?
Yes. Well, there'll be corridors where the winds are going that high. In the northernmost and southernmost areas, the winds won't be that high. But I would say from about 35 degrees north and 35 degrees south, the winds will be the highest.
Will we see this coming, Brooks?
Well, we're already seeing it coming. The hurricanes are getting much, much more intense. Straight-line winds, what are called errant tidal waves, these are huge waves, 100-foot-high waves that race around the planet at 400 to 500 miles an hour. Now, fortunately, the ocean's deep, so they don't, you know, crest and crash. But there are ocean liners that are reporting these errant tidal waves that go racing around the planet. And now the frequency's up to more than one a month.
One a month?
Yes, more than one a month. And this is reported by ocean liners that are out at sea. I know two people that have been on two separate cruises where 900-foot-long ships have almost been turned on their sides at sea.
And your projection of wind speed, for example, 300 miles an hour, that could be a low projection.
It could be, yes. Of course, wind is asymptotic in the sense that it can only go so fast, and then it starts crunching up against the sound barrier. But 300 or 400 mile an hour winds, which is roughly double what you see in a tornado, and look at the tornadoes just in the last 8 weeks in the U.S. They've been devastating. Iowa has been flooded.
St. Louis area has been.
St. Louis area, correct. Just and also up in Maine, they've had bitter cold temperatures. It's in fact here in Washington State, they had the coldest, longest winter they've ever seen. More snow than ever.
Could this trigger an ice age?
It could, and it's funny because ice ages, it's believed in the past, sort of creep up on you. That's not the way they occur at all. Ice ages occur suddenly. They drop 8 to 10 feet of snow. It doesn't melt off during the summer. It reflects a lot of energy back out into space, which is called the albedo effect. Right now, Earth is warming because it's absorbing energy and from the sun and from other sources. But when it reflects that energy out into space, it cools. Now, that occurs two ways. One is if we get very high cloud cover. That is usually accompanied by cosmic radiation during high solar flare activity. Right now, we have no solar flare activity. There's been no sunspots appreciable for months.
Scientists are getting concerned about that.
Yes, and we thought that solar cycle 24 had started. We saw a high-latitude reverse polarity sunspot 3 months ago. But we really haven't seen any follow-ups. And now we've seen sunspot 1,000 from solar cycle 23. And they're rather benign, and they're small, and they don't even last during one revolution of the sun. So, and we're seeing very low solar winds, 300 or 400 kilometers a second, and very low proton counts, which means we're really not receiving that much cosmic radiation from the sun, at least in the wavelength that would cause high-altitude clouds, which would cause the Earth to cool. However, we are beginning to start solar cycle 24, and if it starts in earnest and does what solar scientists think it's going to do, along around 2012, it is going to be intense. And we're talking X-class flares above 7, maybe as high as 9 on a regular basis. This could cause high-altitude cloud cover and really rapid cooling of the Earth.
Edgar Cayce predicted Earth changes on this planet, specifically at a map of North America. It looks like half of the United States is underwater. You think this is very possible?
It is possible, and it has happened before. If you look at the topsoil distributions of the United States, much of the United States has been underwater before. The mineral deposits that are laying right now in farmland across our continent indicate that much of the United States was underwater or under ice at one time. That could happen again. And it doesn't necessarily happen from melting ice caps, because obviously ice floating in water, when it melts, does not raise the water level. Just like ice cubes in a glass melt, actually the water level goes down in the glass instead of comes up, because ice takes up more space in the glass. But interestingly enough, it does add a lot of fresh water to the ocean, and that changes the salinity, which changes the amount of solar radiation it absorbs. When it does that, the Gulf Stream begins to move, and when it moves, it begins to come inland, and that's why this planet, or this continent anyway, up around the Mason-Dixon line, should be largely underwater, except for the mountain ranges.
So Cayce might be right.
He very well could be right.
And we're beginning to see a lot of, with the catastrophes, how we cannot handle even some flooding cases in various parts of this country. We can't handle it.
No, not enough sandbags to hold back. And we're just talking about holding back rivers. Try to hold back the Gulf of Mexico when it comes up the Mississippi River.
You can't do it. You can't do it at all. Now, you know, you mentioned the black hole in the center of the Milky Way, in that we seem to be creating this alignment with it when this occurs as we get closer to 2012. How devastating do you believe this could be?
Well, the ancients believed, and they recorded it as well as they possibly could. They even incorporated it into their religions. Many places call this the serpent bar. They call it the world tree. It is clearly mapping out the elliptical path of the solar system in alignment with this rift in the Milky Way. It is going to be a gravitational event like nothing the Earth has seen for 26,000 years. And we really do not have a lot of solid historical records from 26,000 years ago. We barely have 11,500 years ago, and only then, because the builders in that time frame used stone, and they built their edifices to last through an event like that.
When this occurs, what can people do?
Well, in the book, we cover a lot of aspects of preparation. First, we'll talk about the physical preparation.
Okay, and let's do that when we come right back.